Okay, Gospel of Mark. We are still dealing with some of the introductory stuff, which is not a bad thing. We're right on schedule, kind of. I just don't look at the schedule and just say we're right on top of it. So, what have we talked about so far? Just throw out anything you can remember from the last 2 days outside of roll. It doesn't have a genealogy. Why is that significant, or is it significant? Yeah. Because what do genealogies do? They show inheritance or ownership. What else do they show? From a Jewish perspective primarily, not from a legal one.
Property.
They show property from a legal perspective.
How God worked.
And how God, yes, exactly. How God has orchestrated His plan throughout history. So the fact that the Gospel of Mark doesn't have one doesn't mean that he's not worried about the way God worked throughout history. It means he may be making another emphasis, and that is that Jesus is a servant. And what did we talk about as the heartbeat at one of the central key transition points in the Gospel of Mark? One of the verses. Mark 10:45, right. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Good. What else? What else have we talked about? I think we've talked about more than that, haven't we? Hopefully. Yes.
The 9 through 16.
Mm-hmm. 9 through 20 at the end.
9 through 20 at the end.
Mm-hmm. What did we talk about it?
you said that you give reasons for why you don't think it's authentic.
Yeah, we'll talk about that at the very last day of class, won't we? Awesome. But yeah, that was just a little bit of a teaser to make sure you come back at least the last day of class. Maybe you'll skip everything in between. Yeah?
External evidence points to Mark.
Yes, we ended yesterday talking about authorship. And I suggested even before we started talking about authorship that there are some books where authors and dates may not impact the interpretation of the book very much. But Mark is not like that. Actually, the authorship and the date, which is what we're going to get to in a minute, they really do impact the way that it's colored and the way we can actually read some of the, even the opening verse of Mark. But the external evidence did point that John Mark, in particular, was the author of our gospel. And why is that significant? What does that add to the picture if John Mark was the author? Tom? Yeah, there is some authority issues there, right? He has a right to write it. Because in particular, Eusebius says that he was the amanuensis, in the scribe, not really the scribe, but the note taker, translator is the word he uses, for Peter's sermons, which we'll talk about today. We'll actually read the full, I think we will in this class, I prepared for more than one, but the full quote from Eusebius, which actually talks about, describes the Roman Christians begging for him to write it down, and Peter having to give the approval. Yes?
Is there any reason to believe that Mark and John Mark
There, we just don't have anybody that would fit the perspective on that. And no, there isn't, necessarily. We don't really have another significant Mark, not only in the Bible or in the New Testament, but even in the external evidence. They don't really talk about another significant Mark that would be traveling with Peter at any time like that. So, good question, though.
Where
yeah.
Are the references for John Mark?
Say that again?
Where are the references for John Mark?
The external or internal? He does not write himself into the story except for maybe in the Garden of Gethsemane. Is that what you're asking me? You have Acts 12:12 where it talks about his mom in Jerusalem. You have 1 Peter 5:13 whenever Peter says, John Mark, my son. And then you have, Colossians 4:10. Colossians 4:10 whenever Barnabas is described as John Mark's cousin. Yes, that's accurate. Yeah. What else? What else have we talked about? Yeah, we're going to be talking about that actually both today and tomorrow. That the concept of Messiah, that Jesus comes and offers, that is presented in the Gospel of Mark, is not what was being expected by the Jewish kingdom at all. The concept of the Messiah, the King that's going to be exalted and exalt Israel, being a servant, even a servant of outcasts, doesn't sit too well with Jewish authorities. It may even get you hung on a cross. But we'll talk about that by and by. Good. Anything else? Yeah?
The overlap with Matthew and then with Luke, there's only a 5% originality in Mark.
Yeah. If I take Matthew and Luke, If we lost the Gospel of Mark, we could reconstruct 95% of it. There's only 5% of original unique material in the Gospel of Mark. Yeah, that's interesting. Somewhat significant, I'd think. Anything else? Yeah?
The Messianic secret.
Yeah, one of the key motifs in the Gospel of Mark is the Messianic secret, which we will talk about the very last day of class. Yeah?
Immediately appears 42 times in the Gospel of Mark.
It does. Uh-huh. And how many in the last? See if you can do the math.
We don't have math here.
Okay. Six. Good job. I saw your calculator out. Yes. Euthus is used 42 times, 36 times in the first 10 chapters, 6 times in chapters 11 through 16. What is significant about that?
Slowing down the pace.
Yeah, what we're doing is we're slowing down the pace for 6-7 chapters we spend on 1 week. We're in the first 10, immediately, we race through 3 years. Why? Because not because he's just in a hurry, because he's driving to a point, and that's Jerusalem, the cross, the resurrection. Okay, good. I'm glad we're listening. That's awesome. And I'm not spitting out too much heresy, because everything you said back sounded good. Let's talk about the date. The date of the book, actually, I find this, I'll be honest with you, if you want to know my honest truth. Most books, their dates don't. The whole concept and the talk of dating doesn't really intrigue me very much. It's just kind of like, okay, whatever, just get to the date. But the Gospel of Mark, in particular, the date is huge, because what you can do whenever you get a date, and we're actually doing this in New Testament intro right now. When you get a date for a book, then you can start filling in all the sociological, all the historical events that are happening around the construction of the book. And you can start to see the tenor or the actual mood coming out in the book from the society that it's being written in. Does that make sense? Therefore, it's going to be important for us to look at even the decade in the Gospel of Mark of whenever I'm suggesting that it is written, so that you can see what's happening and what would be the message that's ringing through the Gospel of Mark because of what's happening at that time. Does that make sense? Yes? No? Holler if you hear me? Okay, good. All right. I don't know if I won't say traditional, because it's not the traditional date, but the most conservative dating of Mark, that's the more accurate term, is in the mid-50s. And the reason why, and this actually is held by multiple people on campus here, so if you decide to reject my option and choose this first option, that's fine. There's other good, godly people on this campus that hold this initial option. Does that make sense? Okay, this isn't a cross issue, heresy issue. Well, mid-50s, and the reason why is because of the way they date the book of Acts. They say the book of Acts was dated in 62 AD. That's whenever it was published or written. Why would they say that? Because that's when it ends. Right? Paul's in house arrest in Acts chapter 28, which we know was around 62 or 63. He was released from house arrest around that time and eventually would die in around 68. So, if we don't have his death, well, he probably should have recorded the death if it had already happened. Therefore, Acts must have been written before Paul's death, otherwise he would have included it. That's the argument. As a result, the Gospel of Mark, if Acts is in 62, must be before that. Now why? Why would they say that? Why would the Gospel of Mark need to be dated before Acts?
Acts starts out saying it's his second letter.
Yeah, it's his second letter, and what's the first one? Gospel of Luke. And what do we know about the overlap between Luke and Mark? That more than likely, almost pretty much unanimously, which is, you don't have things like this in scholarship today and throughout history, where it's a pretty much agreed upon fact that Luke used Mark as a source. 48% overlap between those two. And the way in which Luke uses it, we can all trace back that more than likely Mark was the one that wrote it first, and Luke was the one that borrowed it. As a result, if Luke is the first volume of Acts, and Acts ends at 62, the logic then would be that Mark should be dated to around the mid-50s. You see how they get that? It's not illogical. It's just wrong. Just kidding. Kind of. Blah, 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 blah. But I would suggest this. The abrupt ending, now notice what I'm going to do here. I'm going to talk about the dating of Acts in order to get to a dating of Mark. I'm going to suggest that the abrupt ending of the book of Acts does not necessitate, mandate, or even suggest that he was writing up until the point in which history ran out. You see what I mean by that? How many historical biographies today, they're just writing vociferously, and then finally they get to the moment where they're actually writing, so they just say, well, I guess I'm done. And they just stop and move on. Does that happen? Sometimes. It's possible. But it's not altogether likely. Normally they're writing for a purpose. Maybe even a theological one. Instead of going into the detailed arguments like I'm going to next hour with Acts, I'm going to give you a synopsis. There is incredible literary parallels between the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. You guys have heard this from Acts class, right? Where you have, let's look at the book of Acts. At the first half, the first 12 chapters, you have Peter. And he's doing things like healing a lame man. He's raising people from the dead. He's even got these weird miracle stories where his shadow is healing people. You remember that? And what's interesting is whenever you get to Paul, the second half of Acts, you have parallels between the two. He heals a lame man. He raises Eutychus from the dead in chapter 20. He also has a weird miracle account where his sweatbands are healing people. And what's being said there, literally? What? What's being said there, theologically? Why would there be parallels like that? Yes, the same power that's functioning in Peter in his mission, that's not primarily to the Gentiles, is functioning in Paul. Therefore, it validates both ministries because both of these figures parallel the ministry of Jesus. Because in Luke's gospel, you have Jesus healing lame men, you have him raising people from the dead, and you have this weird story of this woman with the flow of blood that walks up and touches the hem of his robe and is healed. Power has left me, he says. What's being said? The ministry of Peter and Paul is carrying on the ministry of Jesus, both to the Jew and to the Gentile. Oh, that's beautiful, isn't it? I love those connections. Those are great. There's another interesting connection between Paul and Jesus. In Luke's gospel, there are five, count them, trials that Jesus goes before and he's found innocent. In the ministry of Paul, he goes through five trials and he's found innocent. The life, the ministry of Jesus is paralleling Paul. Even the trials of Jesus are paralleling Paul. But what doesn't get paralleled in the gospel or in the book of Acts that is really important in the gospel of Luke? The death, resurrection, and ascension. Here's my argument. I think Luke either started or was going to start a third volume to parallel the life, death, or the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus in the church. And that really would fit what's happening in the time period from 60 to 70, wouldn't it? I mean, hello, what happens in the 60s? Do you remember anything from Roman history involving Christians that happens? What happens? Let's look at death first. What happens? Nero, 64, decides to do what? Let's just set fire to, 40% of Rome. Why? Well, the reasons why vary depending on which Roman historian you look at. But it's possible. What's interesting is after he does burn it all down, he uses pretty much all that land to build up his palace. That's convenient. But what's he end up doing? Whenever he realizes that the people are starting to turn on him, what does he do? Yeah, it's not my fault. It was actually those Christians who Suetonius describes as those that are involved in the mischievous superstition. And what happens to Christians? Do you know what happens? Tacitus describes it for us very clearly. It says that Nero just starts persecuting them like crazy in Rome. In very unique and creative ways, at least. We can give him that credit. For what he'll do is he'll have them tied up and people would be wearing animal skins and then they would like jump on top of them and maul them to death. He would impale them inside of his garden and light them on fire to give light to it at night. Christians were going through a rough spell in 64. That's not the only thing that happened to Christians in that decade, is it? What else? What else happened?
Destruction of the temple.
Destruction of the temple. Man. What happened in the destruction of the temple?
Well,
Starts in 66. But who starts the rebellion? The Jews. And what are they doing? What happens is in Caesarea, you have some Greek. The Greeks were antagonistic towards the Jews pretty much all throughout the history of the Jewish-Greek relationships. The Greeks just did not like the Jews. And this goes back even to the time of Caligula, which would have been, let's see, before Nero, it would have been two emperors before. So around 49, or excuse me, around 39 to 41. You have these Greeks down in Jamnia, Dora, and Alexandria. They would take imperial cult statues. You know what imperial cult means? It's whenever you worship the emperor as the god. And they would take these statues that were in honor of the emperor as a god, and they'd go and they'd set them in the synagogues of the Jews. And there's a couple problems with that, isn't there? Help me. From a Jewish perspective, why is that a problem?
Defiled.
Yeah, defiled. In what ways?
Defiled.
Number one, it's a graven image. You can't have a graven image inside of a worship place for God, even if it's not the temple. All of a sudden, you've desecrated the place of worship. And it's a worship of another god. So what do the Jews do? Well, initially, they did it what you're supposed to do. Is they went to Caligula and they had their lawyers and they were appealing. They were saying, hey, you can't do this. This is violating Roman law. You're not allowing us our, in a sense, freedom of religion. That's not a new concept today, okay? Rome had freedom of religion too, and there were parameters just like today. But they say, you're violating that. You're not allowing us to worship because if that statue exists there, then it destroys our whole religion. And so they're going through this. Well, some Jews got impatient. And down in Jamnia, what they decided, they're like, you know what, we're not waiting for this. And they walk in and they destroy the imperial cult statues in the synagogues. How do you think Caligula responded to that? Or does anybody even know how he responded to that? Yeah, he wasn't too happy. That's a good way of saying it. Caligula was the first emperor to say, you know what? Because normally the imperial cult was when an emperor would die, then he would be worshipped as a god. Caligula was the first one that said, I don't want to wait. I want you to worship me right now. And that's what he demanded. And whenever they destroy a statue that was in honor of worshiping him, his response was, okay, fine. What we're going to do then is we're going to build a statue that's 9 feet tall, half me, half Zeus. And we're going to place it in the temple in Jerusalem. Oh, that's not a good idea, is it? We'll talk about the implications of that once we get to Mark 13, because I think it has something to do with the imagery that we see there and in 2 Thessalonians 2. But that's a whole other issue. The point is this. The Greeks and the Jews didn't get along too well, and it goes back a long time. So what happens in 66 is the Greeks in Caesarea, they decide to start offering pagan sacrifices right at the doorstep of the synagogues. They're just punks, man. And the Jews were going to the Romans, they're saying, do something about this. They are once again defiling our area of worship. And the Romans just said, no, you know what? You figure it out. We're not dealing with this. We're not messing with it. And it just ticked the Jews off. So the Jews, all of a sudden, they say, you know what then? We're not going to offer sacrifices in honor of the imperial cult. Because what they would do is in the temple, the Jews struck a deal. They say, we will not worship, we will not offer sacrifices to you, but we will offer sacrifices for you, to our God. And they're like, all right, fine. They say, we're not doing that anymore. You know what else we're not going to do? We're not going to pay your taxes. In any country, at any time, you don't pay taxes, you're going to get in trouble. Just write that down. That's a ministry principle, okay? It's just the way it is. But in the Roman world, taxes was not about building up the empire. Taxes was about making sure the subjects of your empire knew who was in charge. That's what it was about. It was a political propaganda statement. That's why the taxes they would have to pay would be the coins that would be honoring the emperor as a god on it. The same coin that Jesus says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Why? Look whose image is on it. Why would you want to keep that filthy thing anyway? The taxes was a way of telling people, you know who's in charge and it's not you. And one of the ways in which they would do that is they would overtax them. Sometimes we have estimates that taxes would have been anywhere from 45% to 60%. 45% to 60%. And that doesn't even count tithing. If you're a Jew. You hear this? This is one of the reasons why a lot of the Jews were having a hard time even being able to own anything. Because the taxes were so much, they'd eventually have to go into debt and forfeit everything they owned. Even if the land had been in their family for generations and generations. Taxes was a means of the empire saying, we are in charge. And so the Jews in 66 say, we're not going to pay taxes anymore. And you know what we're actually going to do? We're going to start minting our own coins. Oh, ugh. Those are called fighting words, friends. And what ends up happening is the 12th Legion, a Fulminata known as the Thundering Legion, is sent from Caesarea over into Jerusalem to confront what's happening in 66. And what happens is the Jewish rebels wipe the Legion out. Whoa. Now it's not just fighting words. Now there's an actual war. And from 66 to 70, Rome is in complete disarray because the Jews were actually winning some pretty significant battles until they hired a guy by the name of Vespasian to come in and start wiping out all the region, who eventually would become the emperor that reigns in 70. Do you see how this is all filling in what's happening? What else happens in the decade of the 60s and 70s? We do have persecution of Christians by Nero. We also have this explosion of the Jewish rebellion. Let me connect the Jewish rebellion to the Christians. The Romans didn't look at just Christians, just Jews. They believed that Christians were just a sect of the Jews. Therefore, what the Jews were doing also would fall down on the heads of the Christians. Which is one of the reasons why what you see later is the Christians trying to be very clear that they are not Jewish. Because they don't want to pay for the sins of the people that they don't even belong to technically. Because the Messiah makes a big difference. It does, I promise. I don't care what people say, even about the state of the salvation of people in Israel today. Salvation makes a big difference. The Messiah does. That's for another talk. What else, though, happens in the decade of the 60s and 70s that would be pretty difficult for the Christians to deal with?
Peter and Paul die.
Yeah. In Rome. Peter is crucified upside down in around 67. Paul is beheaded on the Ostian Way in 68. And they're not the only Christian leaders that are dying, mind you. Because in other regions around the world, we also have many other of the apostles dying, and even James, Jesus' brother, who gets stoned in 66 in Jerusalem. What's happening then in this decade? Absolute chaos. Which could be easily paralleled, now I'm going back to my original point, could be easily paralleled in a third book that first of all starts describing the history of the church, and it looks like they're dead. Doesn't it? Kind of. But then what happens? You see, the destruction of the temple was enormous for the Christians. Because the destruction of the temple vindicated all that Jesus had claimed about himself and about his people. Why? Help me develop that thought. Yeah, because I don't find it insignificant that in Luke 21, Matthew 24, and Mark 13, the Synoptic Gospels, all three of them describe the destruction of the temple as prophesied by Jesus. Why? Not only just because he predicted it is important, but why is that event important? Theologically, this is enormous, isn't it? The purpose of the temple throughout the Old Testament and into the first century was to be the place on earth, the place where heaven and earth intersect. The place. See, at that time, it wasn't that God was dwelling in all of his people. That's New Testament theology. Old Testament theology is God was dwelling in the Holy of Holies. Which is one of the reasons why they'd have to tie, you know, a rope around the ankle of the high priest when he'd go in there once a year. Because if he died, no one could go in there and stand the presence of God, especially if they're unclean. And so they'd be able to have an opportunity to pull him back out if he did die. Maybe he forgot to name a sin at the altar or something. You see the idea? The temples where heaven and earth intersect. But Jesus comes, and he starts talking about this weird thing called the Holy Spirit. You ever wonder why Paul calls us the temple? Because we are now where heaven and earth intersect. Why? Because of Acts 2. Right? You are the temple of God. And it's not just some, you know, kind of cool title that you can just slap on like a name tag. It gives you an identity and a mission. You are the intersection of heaven and earth. So that when you go somewhere, you are actually representing God on earth. It's one of the other reasons why he calls us the body of Christ. Huh? Because Jesus was... That's why Jesus could say, no, actually, I am the temple. Why would he say that? Because he was where heaven and earth were intersecting. It's called incarnation. It's the mystery of the humanity and the divinity of Christ. He says, I am the temple, and I will destroy this temple and resurrect it in 3 days. This is where heaven and earth intersect. And then Paul looks at us and he says, and that's why you are the body of Christ. Because you are where heaven and earth intersect. Because the Holy Spirit's living and empowering you. The destruction of the temple was enormous for Christian theology. Because what it did was it vindicated everything that had happened before it. It's one of the reasons why I believe that whenever Jesus resurrected, that they were still waiting for one thing to happen before His second coming, and only one. And that one thing was the destruction of the temple. Which is the reason why all three of the first Gospels record it. The fourth Gospel, you're saying, why didn't that record it? It was written in 95, 96, that area. It had already happened a long time ago. Not that it wasn't important, but why repeat a detail? Instead, that detail is added in Matthew, Mark, and Luke as a point to show this is when we will be vindicated. You follow me here? Therefore, the destruction of the temple is nothing to bat an eye at. It's very important to the Christian because it actually says we are the people of God as Jesus suggested. So still, what does this have to do with the date? This is my argument. I believe that would make a perfect point in the third volume of Acts to talk about, in parallel, literally, the resurrection of Jesus. And so what's the ascension? Christians after 70 were having a rough time because of what had happened with the Jews. Really rough time. Rome didn't want to have anything to do with anything remotely related to Judaism at all. Christian sect, it doesn't matter. We're going after all of them. They're a nuisance. They're all involved in this mischievous superstitions. And frankly, it'd be better if they were just gone. Now, they didn't go on a mass eradication, although they could have. What they didn't say is they put sociological pressures and tensions on them that we'll get through throughout the rest of this class. The point is this. I believe that the third volume of Acts would end with the parallel with the ascension, with the exhortation for the Christians to live in the present, understanding where they will belong in the future. Because if they would die at the hands of Rome, it wouldn't be the end of their story. For like Jesus, they too would ascend to glory. And all of a sudden, we don't have to date the book of Acts at 62. All of a sudden, we can allow it a little bit more flexibility. Maybe it would even make sense in the 70s to write the book of Acts as a means of showing that five times we were put on trial by Rome. Five times. And every single time Rome found us innocent, why now do you think we are guilty? Well, that's kind of cool. You see what I'm arguing here? So now, what we've done, if that's true with the book of Acts, now we've unlocked not only the flexibility of the book of Acts' date, but also the flexibility of the book of Mark's date. I believe what the external evidence reveals, and that's that the book of Mark was probably written anywhere from 67 to 70 AD, right in the middle of the heart of the chaos. Where do I get that? Let's look at, remember, authorship and date. You always look at external and then internal evidence. The external evidence. Number one, The Anti-Marcionite Prologue. Google it, you can read it. It's for a second century document. The Anti-Marcion. Marcion was a convicted heretic by the church eventually. I'm not going to go into the basic details, but it was a form of Gnosticism that he was promoting, which would say the Old Testament God is different from the New Testament God. This one was evil. This one was good. Let's get rid of all the Old Testament. And there's much more implications beside that. That's the oversimplified version. Nevertheless, documents upon documents were written against Marcion, and one of them is this Anti-Marcionite prologue. And what it indicates is that Mark was published after the death of Peter. Notice what I said. Published. This is one of the things that drives me nuts when we start talking about the dating of a book. Having gone through the process of writing the book in the last 2 years, I can tell you that even though the copyright on my book says 2011... it's not really when it was being written. It was being written over a period of 2 years. And that doesn't even count the 10 years before that that I was researching it. So to be able to say, oh yes, Mark wrote it in this year, is to reduce the process down to almost foolishness. Instead, I believe it was published in that time, but he was writing it as he was listening to which apostle? Peter. He's listening to Peter's sermons, and he's just like, oh, that's good stuff. And then eventually, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Anti-Marcionite prologue, though, suggests that it was published after the death of Peter. Why would that make sense? Why would it be published after his death?
Because now you don't have Peter to hear the stories.
Exactly. Because now you don't have the eyewitness stories of Peter to talk about it. And even though they were an oral culture, there are many different people around the world that had not heard Peter's stories yet. It would make a good sense, and maybe if this is the first gospel, to write it down so that then we can preserve what was orally already well preserved. Anti-Marcionite gospel says that also Irenaeus Against Heresies 3.1.2 suggests the same thing. Peter died in AD 67. You see where I'm getting my date? External evidence says it was published after the death of Peter. Peter dies in 67. Why would I push it back to the mid-50s? Let's look at internal evidence. Internal evidence. Mark chapter 13 will be a passage that many people are afraid of because it looks an awful lot like Matthew 24. And the reason why people are afraid of it is because people just take it out of context and do whatever they want with it. Primarily, the rapture left behind people. Mark chapter 13, and I'll argue for this later, is talking about the destruction of the temple. But the way it describes specifically the abomination of desolation is kind of vague. Let me read it for you. It's Mark chapter 13, verse 14. When you see the abomination that causes desolation standing where it does not belong, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Okay, you didn't really tell me what the abomination of desolation was, but whenever I see it, I'm supposed to get out of Dodge. That's all I really know. Now, Luke 21, 20 through 21, these are parallel passages. They're both talking about the same thing, but with a little bit of a hint of a different perspective. Listen to how Luke describes this abomination of desolation. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, Roman armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. What does that sound like? Now, this is not anti-supernatural. What does that, from a historical perspective, sound like? Somebody is describing the details because they're looking back on it. Doesn't it? Because what you see in Matthew and Mark, it's this vague, when the abomination of desolation comes, then make sure you get out of Dodge. Both of them are vague. And both of them are right. They both knew it was going to be destroyed whenever this abomination of desolation sign occurred. And at that time, all of them say, get out of Dodge. But what Matthew and Mark seem to indicate is they don't really know how it will be destroyed or what the sign is. They just know one's coming. Luke, on the other hand, says, I'll tell you what the sign is. It's whenever the armies, the Roman ones, surround the temple, surround the city, get out. And matter of fact, what we actually have happen, and I'm just giving you my whole Mark 13 lecture now, so you can just skip it later, I guess. Where am I at? Oh, yeah. In 66, whenever that, remember that legion I told you that came from Caesarea that was destroyed by the Jews? When the reason why they were destroyed was because of a serious tactical error. They surround the whole city. It's actually the guy named Cestius Gallus. He surrounds the city and they actually plow through one of the walls, the western wall of the city. And they get right up to the temple and they start to kindle the fire to start burning down the walls. And for some reason, no, even Josephus, we'll read this later, is confused. For some reason, Cestius Gallus says, let's call it off and go back to Caesarea. And they left Caesarea, and on their way back to Caesarea, the Jewish rebels kept just picking them off and decimated the whole legion before they even made it back. And it's at that point that Eusebius says, and Christians began at that point to flee to Pella. Why? Because they had seen the abomination that would cause desolation. Huh. That's interesting. Because we don't get that clarity in Mark 13, but we do get it in Luke 21. Which would make my suggestion thus. Mark 13 was written before the fact, hence prophesying in ways that would become more clear after the fact. Both of them contain the similar language because they're both talking about the same thing. It's still a prophetic prediction that Jesus is making that did come true. Do you hear me in that? It says not anti-supernatural. I'm not suggesting that the reason why Luke was more accurate is because he was later. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying from a historical perspective, that actually seems to fit the evidence. Therefore, even the internal evidence seems to suggest a date that would agree with the external evidence. And that is that Mark was probably written not in the mid-50s, but in 67 to 70. So what would be the audience or in the occasion? Well, first of all, we note that... Whoa! I did have that one in here. Maybe I should read that to you. That's a good thing to read. Yeah, let me read that to you. Let me describe to you once again, remind you of the occasion of why this was being written. Because remember the Nero persecution in 64. Let's listen to how Tacitus describes this in Annals 15. He says, consequently, to get rid of the report that Nero had set the fire, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. A most mischievous superstition, he says. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. How did they plead guilty? Yeah, I'm a Christian. They wouldn't deny Jesus, and that equaled guilt. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted. Not so much of a crime of firing the city, did you hear that? Not really because they set fire to the city, but more because of their hatred against mankind. What would make him say that they hated mankind? What would make him say that? It's called Roman propaganda. Whenever you're a Christian, a community inside of Rome, Rome claims to be the kingdom of all kingdoms that has brought peace to the earth. And whenever you're a kingdom, or whenever you're a people, and you're saying, actually, we belong to a different kingdom and a different king, and he's the one that rules the world, you won't make a lot of friends with the Romans anyway. Why did they hate mankind? Because they're claiming another king, another kingdom's coming. But our kingdom and our king was ordained by the gods. Therefore, they're claiming and believing and proclaiming this is threatening the security of our entire empire. That's not going to keep peace with the gods if they're being mocked and taunted and rejected and something opposite of what they want is being proclaimed. Therefore, these Christians aren't about love. They hate us because otherwise their message would be affirming Rome and not challenging it. See how that makes sense? Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his gardens for the spectacle, hence lit on fire and have the garden. You see what's happening? The occasion of the audience of the Gospel of Mark is this. He's writing to Christians in Rome who've had a rough decade. And with the things that are happening with the Jewish revolt in 67 to 70, it looks like it's just getting worse. And their temptation at that point would be to do what with their Christian witness? Hide it. Right? It's a pretty tempting thing whenever they say, how about I strip you, beat you, and maybe even fillet you on top of a lamp, or you can say, I don't believe in Jesus anymore. And Mark writes down and he says, but you have to understand that if you die like that, you're just uniting with your King in His mission. And what happens to Him will happen to you. Both the death and the suffering and the resurrection. All of a sudden, the message of Mark has a different tenor. It's not just an apologetic of what happened to Jesus or a historical document. It's a document that demands a reaction. It's a document of exhortation. It's looking at a group, even you today, 21st century Christians, and saying your witness is more important than your life. Your witness is more important than your life. Therefore, if you do things to preserve your life over and above your witness, you are in disobedience not only to the commands of Christ, but to His very example as seen in the Gospel of Mark. All of a sudden, the author in the day, and you know who's writing this? John Mark, who in Pamphylia got a little scared and abandoned the mission. And now he's writing a document saying, don't abandon the mission. I've done it. Paul and Barnabas both know he did it, right? Because what happens in Acts 15? I don't want anything to do with that guy. He abandoned us. And Barnabas says, that's my cousin you're talking about there, Paul. And even though he abandoned us, he's grown up now and he deserves a second chance. No, he doesn't. Fine, we're splitting ways. That's fine with me. John Mark, the timid little boy, is looking at Peter, who was also pretty timid. But he sees Peter boldly proclaiming something that even leads to his death. And John Mark writes this book, publishes this book, to look at Christians and say, you need to act like Peter. You need to act like Jesus. Because that's how we win. And all of a sudden, the date and the authorship of Mark is not that boring. It's actually kind of exciting, at least to me. How many minutes do we have left? Three thoughts, reflections, questions. Not in that order. What does that make you think? Or I shouldn't ask the question before that. Does it make you think? No. Of course it does, right? Even if your thinking is disagreeing, dialogue with me. Yes?
When you were talking about the possibility of a third volume written by Luke, I don't want to bash on my Acts teacher, and I'm not going to say who it was. Mm-hmm. How come that was never brought up? Is that not a commonly held perspective
here? It's not commonly held perspective here. That's the most accurate assessment. Yeah. It's not unheard of throughout the history of... It's not like I just created that out of nothing. But no, it's not. And it's for no like political reasons or anything like that. It's just where they take their stance. But again, hear my heart whenever I say that. Just because me and the other professors somewhat disagree on that, it doesn't mean that I think they're any less scholarly or any less godly or anything like that. That's one of the things I love about working here, is we're allowed to disagree on some of those things. I mean, there are some things we can't disagree on, like, you know, what Jesus accomplished on the cross and the fact that He did resurrect. Those are watershed issues for me. But a 10-year or an 8-year difference in the dating of a book, although I think it drastically affects the interpretation of the book, it doesn't affect the salvation of Jesus Christ. Good question, though. Good question. What else?
Do other professors agree with this date and reasoning?
Of the Gospel of Mark? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if I can make a list. But I have had conversations with a couple that didn't completely disagree with this. Does that make sense? Anything else? Yeah?
Are there inspired books that we don't know about?
Well, let me ask. I think that you're asking a question behind a question. And I could be wrong, but normally that question comes out of the fear of, wait a minute, do we not have the whole story? The answer is you do have the whole story. We do know there was another Corinthian letter. He mentions it in 1 Corinthians. In my former letter. Hold on, there's a one here. We do not have every single thing that every apostle ever wrote. We don't. And to suggest that we have all of them is to really underestimate the ministry of the apostles. But these were the ones that were preserved, I don't believe just by the community, but I believe by the Holy Spirit, to give us the whole message so that we can come to a saving knowledge of Jesus. So the answer is yes, but you don't need to fear. It's not like we're missing something. It's not like there's a secret. The third one says, actually, the resurrection didn't happen. Even though the other, 27 affirm it. You know what I mean? So we need to make sure. These questions are good, but we need to keep them in the context of a balanced line of thinking, because sometimes our emotional tremoring starts to overreact, and it scrambles up the reality of what's really happening here. But no, we don't have every letter that Paul ever wrote. But we have the ones that gives us what we need to know. And that's called both faith and trust in the one who wrote them. That's a lot of times it comes down to a faith issue. I need absolutely everything. I need absolute certainty. Or you don't. You just need Jesus. Yes?
I guess it would also be important to know that, about this, that the other options for existing stuff, I'm thinking specifically out of the Gnostic writings.
Oh, yeah.
Ridiculous and the data.
Yeah.
If you're ever reading about those, don't be shocked because they're ridiculous. Go and read them.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Gospel of Thomas is huge, like the historical Jesus stuff. We found this lost gospel, da-da-da. Read it. If it did exist at the time which the Gospels were compiled, it did exist probably by the time which the canon was, there's a reason why it didn't make it in. Because for one of the things, at the very end of the Gospel of Thomas, which I find is quite ironic, it says that women, in order to make it into heaven, have to be converted to males before they can go through the pearly gates. Okay? You're dismissed. I love you guys.